It has been a long, long night for Jesus and his disciples. It had begun for the disciples with shattering revelations as Jesus stooped to wash their feet in the upper room. They were given a hint at the depth of his love for them and the degree to which he would humble himself in his service for them. If they were deeply offended by their rabbi putting on the garb of the most menial of slaves and doing the unthinkable, a Jew washing the feet of others, then the events that would unfold in the hours to come would shake them to the core. It is hardly surprising then that as the events unfold, we witness these 11 men deserting their teacher, even denying him. How much they had to learn. Jesus himself knew all that would happen to him. He has prayed to his heavenly Father. He has been strengthened by angelic beings in the Garden of Gethsemane. He has determined to follow through with the plan that was devised before time began. And now, having been questioned by the high priests, he finds himself arraigned before Pilate, the representation of the Roman authority that was over Israel at that time. The Jews have dragged him there from the house of Caiaphas, where, though John does not record it, the Sanhedrin has gathered and has found him guilty of blasphemy. He must be put to death. And so they bring him to the courtroom of Pilate. They themselves cannot enter. It is the Passover. The Passover feast itself has already been eaten, as we have observed in our earlier studies. It is now into the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which followed immediately on the Passover and lasted for 7 days and was so integrally united with the Passover feast itself that the term Passover could refer to the feast itself, the meal that was eaten together by a family or a group within a home, or it could refer to the entirety of this week of feasting. And it's in this respect that it's referred here in the 28th verse. The Jews could not enter the headquarters of the governor lest they be defiled and be unable to participate in this ongoing feast that would continue for the next few days. Who knows what could cause them defilement in that place? It may be a temporary defilement that could be cleansed away at nightfall, or it could be a more dramatic defilement that would require a full week before a ceremonial cleanness could be restored. It doesn't really matter which, even the shorter term defilement would prevent them from fully participating in the feasting and festivities of that week. They do not go in, and so Pilate comes out to them. We observe then that as he asks his questions, the Jews are somewhat taken aback. "What accusation are you bringing against this man?" he asks. And they respond, "If he wasn't doing something evil, would we have brought him to you?" It would seem then that they are assuming that this is just a matter of course. That they would bring him to Pilate, and Pilate would say, "Oh, this is the man. Very well, take him away." You see, he already knows something about the events of the previous evening. After all, he had authorized the contingent of soldiers to accompany Judas and the high priests and the temple guard to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus had been arrested. He obviously knew to some degree what the Jewish leaders had on their minds and the purposes for the contingent of soldiers. And so they think that he has basically already given his go-ahead to the execution of this man. They think that this will just be a formality. But, well, Pilate wasn't really a friend of the Jews. And he was a man who made their lives as difficult as he could for them. And he is determined then that he will make them go through every process necessary before he will let them have their way. "What accusation do you bring against this man? Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." But of course, he knows, and he's rubbing it in, that they cannot, if they require an execution, judge him by their own law. They can find him guilty of a misdemeanor deserving of death, but they cannot execute. That was the prerogative of the Romans in their empire, and they guarded it zealously. "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death," they admit. And so the words that Jesus has spoken, "The Son of Man must be lifted up," come true. His death would not be the death by stoning that was the law of the Israelites, but the death of crucifixion that was preferred by the Romans. So Pilate entered his headquarters, and he called to Jesus. And again we have a hint that he knows what the charge is. "Are you the King of the Jews?" Now of course that was not the charge by which the Sanhedrin had found him guilty. They had found him guilty of blasphemy. He made himself out to be the Son of God, and therefore he was guilty and required to die. But of course Pilate wouldn't be concerned about such a thing. And so they had to present their case against Jesus in political terms. "He makes himself out not to be the Son of God, but the King of the Jews." And Jesus, in order to give an appropriate answer, becomes the interrogator. "Do you say this of your own accord? Have you worked this out? Or has others said this to you about me?" And Pilate acknowledges your own nation. The chief priests have delivered you, or it could be translated, have betrayed you to me. You see, the irony of this whole situation, the Jews had no love for the Romans. They would love to see them defeated and removed from Jerusalem and from Judea. They are no friend of Pilate's. But their hatred of Jesus is so great that they are willing to enter into this alliance with their enemy. They will betray their king to this foreign power in order to have their way. "What have you done?" Pilate asks. "Why is it that your own people would betray you to me? What is it that you have done that they would have such a deep hatred for you that they would even align themselves with me, a man they hate?" And Jesus responds, "This kingdom, my kingdom, it's not of this world. If it had been of this world, I would have been delivered. My servants would have fought. I came peacefully," he's saying. "I came without any attempt to escape." "Oh, you are a king then," Pilate says, and Jesus' response, "You say that I am a king," could very well be translated, you are right in saying I am a king." It's a positive assertion. "Yes, you are right. You're saying I am a king. But my kingdom is based on truth. And my followers are those who love the truth, who listen to the truth." In a sense, Jesus is disowning these people who have brought him to Pilate. They do not love the truth. They do not seek the truth. They will not hear the truth. And here is also almost an invitation to Pilate. "Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate, will you listen to my voice?" "What is truth?" he says, shrugging his shoulders as he departs from there. And tells the Jews, "I do not find any guilt in him." That could have been the end of the story. No guilt. No execution. Why is it that Pilate doesn't stop there? Why doesn't he simply release him? Well, he's aware of their hatred. He's aware too that there's a crowd of people in Jerusalem who could quite easily turn into a mob that could get out of hand. "I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. Do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews?" Here's a way out that he can bring these Jewish leaders on board, that in a sense they can choose to acquit him. But they don't. "Not this man, but Barabbas." Barabbas was a robber, John tells us. Elsewhere we know that he was involved in an insurrection. So again, we have irony here. Here are the Jews seeking to help Pilate by getting rid of a king pretender who could undermine his authority. But they want him to release Barabbas, who had actually been involved in a rebellion and was now in prison because of it. Now again, Pilate is not convinced, and he still seeks to find a way to have Jesus released. Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged, we're told. Now there were different degrees of flogging that were used by the Romans. There was a fairly mild flogging. I hesitate to use that word because even that I wouldn't want to undergo. It's probably that Pilate inflicts upon Jesus at this point. And it is likely that there was a second flogging, because the worst flogging, which would appear to have been inflicted upon Jesus, involved flogging with leather straps that were impregnated with pieces of lead or bone. And the flogging was so severe that some people actually died during the flogging. But it was a flogging that was also associated with crucifixion. In other words, when a man was crucified, prior to the crucifixion, he was flogged with this most severe form of flogging. And that would account, therefore, for what we know from the other Gospels, that though Jesus started out bearing his own cross, he did not carry it all the way to the site of crucifixion. But another man was called. He was so weakened by this severe flogging that had brought him close to death itself that he was unable to carry the cross all the way by himself. But at this point, the flogging that Jesus underwent was a more mild flogging, and it may in fact be that is described in verse 2. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and they put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they struck him with their hands. They mocked him. Here these Roman soldiers are having their fun. And Pilate, I think, hopes that this flogging will be enough to bring out some compassion from the Israelites and a willingness to let him off with this punishment itself. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him. This is the extent of the punishment that I am willing to inflict upon this man that is innocent." And here we see a man coming out with a rudely woven crown upon his head, probably made by thorns from a palm that could be as much as 12 inches long. Here was a man arrayed in a purple robe, spattered with the blood that had dripped down from his forehead. His eyes and cheeks were all puffed and bloodied from the repeated slaps and punches of the Roman soldiers. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." And the chief priests cry out, "Crucify him. We don't want him." In exasperation, Pilate replies, "You take him and crucify him. I find no guilt in him." Of course, he knows they can't. "We have a law." The Roman prefect or procurator had a responsibility to ensure that the local laws were carried out as well as the edicts from Rome. "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die. Why? Because he has made himself the Son of God." Here we have the reason why they've condemned him: blasphemy. And then we have a strange response from Pilate. When he heard this statement, we're told he was even more afraid. More afraid than what? He doesn't seem to have been afraid up to this point. And so it may be better translated that he became very much afraid. But why should he become very much afraid? Well, like most Romans, Pilate would have been a superstitious man. And there were people who had so marked themselves out from society that they were deemed to have something of divinity resting upon them. And this accusation then, albeit coming from the Jews, struck Pilate with a sense of foreboding and fear. Perhaps by this point he has heard the message recorded by the synoptic writers from his wife: "Have nothing to do with this innocent man." And what does he see? He sees a man who he's just had flogged, with a crown of thorns on his head, and a face that has been beaten beyond recognition, a purple robe of mockery around his shoulders. And this innocent man, has God on his side? He enters again and says to Jesus, "Where are you from? Who are you?" But Jesus gives him no answer. Pilate says to him, "Will you speak to me? Don't you know who I am? I have the authority to release you and to crucify you." And Jesus says to him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless this had been given to you from above." Now, he's not speaking specifically here about the authority that Pilate has. He's speaking about the circumstances that Pilate finds himself in. Of course, it's true that all authority is granted by the God who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, certainly. But the point that Jesus is making to Pilate here is that this circumstance, these events that Pilate finds himself in the middle of have been brought about by God. You wouldn't have any authority over me to either release me or to crucify me unless these circumstances had happened as a result of a higher power at work. It's because I have been delivered over to you that you have any authority over me. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. Pilate, you see, is something of a passive person in these events. I mean, he himself has repeatedly said that Jesus is innocent. And it's only his fear of losing his power, of getting in trouble with the emperor, that eventually causes him to hand Jesus over for crucifixion. No, Jesus says, you're not the one who is most culpable for these events and the outcome of them. He who handed me over to you is more guilty. Not that Pilate is innocent, but the Jews and Caiaphas, as their authoritative leader, bears the guilt of this execution. And we're told that from then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend," as if they were. "Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." And so Pilate, hearing these words, sits down on the judgment seat, passes sentence on Jesus. But note how he does it. He says to the Jews, "Behold your king." This beaten, weak specimen of a man. He's the one who's a threat against Caesar. "Is this the only kind of king you can muster?" Pilate in effect says to them. And this is happening, we're told, on the day of preparation of the Passover at about the sixth hour. And we need another bit of explanation if you want to be able to answer those who would see here a discrepancy between the synoptic writers. Mark tells us that it was about the third hour, 9 o'clock in the morning, over against the sixth hour, which would be midday. But people didn't have watches in those days. And someone saying it was about the third hour, it could quite easily have been 10:30 rather than 9. And someone saying it's about the sixth hour, it could quite easily have been 10:30, 11 o'clock rather than midday. You see, John's point is that these proceedings have been dragged out over some length of time. We can read the whole account in a few minutes. It suggests then that the mocking of the soldiers while Pilate spoke to the Jews was not a brief affair, and that the debates that were going on between Pilate and the Jews is just summarized here. And all the movement back and forward, all of that has taken time. And all of this, Jesus has endured. It's the preparation of the Passover, not the Passover feast, we must understand. The term preparation seems only to be used as a specific term to refer to the preparation for the Sabbath, for the seventh day of the week. This was Friday, the day of preparation. Now, it's It's put in terms of the preparation of the Passover as a kind of an abbreviation, if you like. This was the day of preparation for the Sabbath of Passover week. And this was important, you see, because in a few hours' time, the Sabbath would begin. And the Jews would be desperately concerned to ensure that any crucifixion that took place on this day would be over and finished, completed and out of the way before the Sabbath began. They have but a few hours left. And so they cry out with all the more vehemence, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And then the stunning response to the question, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." We have no king but Caesar. Well, you see, they've just delivered their only true king into the hands of Caesar. They have no king. They have betrayed him, and he will die. Some 4 millennia earlier, a question was asked that has an echo in the words of Pilate to Jesus. "What have you done?" That question was first asked in the Garden of Eden, after Adam and Eve had eaten the forbidden fruits from the tree that God had commanded them that they should not eat. And having eaten of that fruit, they had become aware of their nakedness. And on hearing the voice of God in the garden, they hid themselves, trying to cover themselves with fig leaves sewn together. And God asked them, "What have you done?" What have they done? They've blasphemed the living God, believing the words of the serpent, "If you eat of this fruit, you will be like God." And they longed for that. They desired that. They wanted to be like God. They wanted to be equal with God. They wanted to have the knowledge that God had and the power that God had. And it was all promised to them in that fruit that God had forbidden. "He's forbidden you, because if you eat it, you will be like him. You will not need him anymore. You will be your own gods." And their act of eating that fruit was an act of blasphemy against the one true God in whose image they had already been made. They were like him, but they wanted to be equal with him. So it is with every human being. We want to be masters of our own destiny. We want to live by our own rules. We want to determine our own lives. And we will not have another to rule over us. Coupled with this is an act of treason. They were his subjects by creation and by command. They were set there in that garden as a creature of the Creator, to superintend it on his behalf, and to display in the world his character. but they rebel. They commit treason. They go their own way and do their own thing. What have you done? God asked. And the question is asked of Jesus. What have you done? The Jews say, he's blasphemed. He calls himself the Son of God. He makes himself out to be equal with the divine. This is what he has done. But he is divine. He is the Son of God. And Pilate says to them, behold the man. Behold your king. And the word has come to his own. And his own people did not recognize him. He is unknown to them. What has he done? He's committed treason. He's made himself out to be a king. He seeks to usurp the authority of Caesar. He's a traitor. He's a rebel. But he is a king. And he is Caesar's lord. And Pilate does not recognize him. And the Jews do not understand who he is. You see, Jesus stands here on trial in the place of blasphemers. Jesus stands here on trial in the place of those who commit treason against the living God. Jesus, who is God. Jesus, who has all authority, is found guilty, is sentenced, and will be punished, though he's innocent. He's on trial instead of us. He stands there beaten and bloodied as a pretender. When he is the Lord of all, can we comprehend it? That even as he stood there before those people with that comical crown upon his head, his mind still superintended the movements of the planets. He still ruled with all authority in the far corners of the world. And these very events were orchestrated by his own will and power. And he humbled himself for people who deserve to be beaten and executed at the hands of a holy God against whom we have lived blasphemous, treasonous lives. And he did it to take our place. who knows how many of those soldiers who slapped his face would in years to come find mercy. We know that many of the priests in Jerusalem became followers of Jesus in years to come. But on this day, they cry out, "Crucify him." He was struck by them, for them. He was tortured by them, for them. The question is, was he struck for you? Was he tortured for you? Do you know who this man is? Do you know where he came from? Do you believe that he is the Word become flesh, dwelling among us? The incarnation of the living God who humbled himself and became a man and became obedient to death, even death on a cross for us? Do you believe that he endured all of this because you are guilty before God and you are under sentence of death before God, and this is the only way that you can be free from that? Do you believe that Jesus bore the wrath of the Holy God against you, that he took your punishment? Everyone who is of the truth listens to his voice.